You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hey, out there in archaeology podcast land, this is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and this is episode 155 of your Rock Art Podcast, and we're honored and blessed to have Joseph Williams, who's the founder of the Seven Fires Corporation, and he's here with us today to talk about both the nature of the outreach and effort to connect with Native Americans. He himself is a Native American, and just so I can be transparent, I'm one of the executive board members of the Seven Fires Corporation as well. Joseph, are you there?
Yes, doctor. Thank you. I appreciate having me on, Alan. Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back. I think we had you once before, didn't we, quite a while ago?
I believe so. Maybe a number of years ago.
Yeah.
But yes, it was a great time for a debut.
Yeah. We had about 6 years of podcasting here. And Joseph, it's lovely to have you back.
Thank you.
Why don't you give us a little intro to your perspective on Native American outreach and the nature of the Seven Fires Corporation and your interest in the science of anthropology, archaeology, and study of rock art, please.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think that we are at the forefront of a technical revolution when it comes to the archaeological front. And I believe that Seven Fires Corporation embodies the very nature of how we are trying to stay in step, if you will, with AI technology and incorporating that with our archaeological research.
Yeah, well, that's fabulous. And I have begun to understand that you have, you know, quite a background in that and also have at your disposal a rather unique rock art site, which has some significance. Perhaps you can share a bit about the significance of that rock art site.
Yes, thank you. It is a very elaborate site, probably one of the most beautiful and largest panels there is when it comes to actual paintings at a rock art site. So I believe that it's our, how should I say, primary focus. And Village of the Sun, I think it was named. You may need to correct me on that, doctor.
Yeah, so the site is in California, and it's in Southern California, and it's in an area that is, you know, somewhat protected. I believe it's owned by a corporation, correct?
Yes, exactly. So that's more or less the structure that I base this corporation on that I'm operating in. And I think that we have, you know, a few topics that we could have as a discussion for preserving this rock art for future generations to come, applying AI science.
Yeah. Can you give us a word picture, a bit of a description of the site, perhaps?
I'd say that one of the strongest points about the panel would probably be, if not this, a representation of the sun, but also of a fish, a large fish. And it happens to be that here in the valley which I live, the Antelope Valley at one point in time was, in fact, a large lake surrounded by an antelope. And so, you know, we see this site as a representation of how geology has actually worked and evolution as well. So I believe the site's dated at being better than 2,000 years old. Probably even going back when it comes to Professor Robinson's work, making it an actual prehistoric site. So it's been there for.
So I guess the site is a polychrome, many-colored panel. It sort of has the look of either a Chumash or Yokuts or even Kauai-Asu site here in California. And what's really remarkable about it, besides having archaeoastronomical significance, is the landform itself represents some sort of a bear or a grizzly bear in its look. Am I correct?
Yes, exactly. A lot of these sites, having been worn for so long with the elements, have actually taken these forms, which is what deems this site as prehistoric. Now that we have access to AI, I'd say science, mainly because it's not just a limitation of GPT. Interfacing with the new AI Grok 4 expert, for example, we can actually have schematics and diagrams of the prototype design on the AI mechanics, involving being able to produce 3D stage,
imagery.
That someone who is studying or wants to experience what it would be like has a three-dimensional environment that they can immerse themselves in.
Right. And this is sometimes called virtual reality. Isn't it a VR?
Yes. Yeah. Right, exactly. Not everybody has the goggles and the equipment necessary to try to make a 3D environment at their home, for example. But, you may need to go to a particular library or museum to be able to actually experience this 3D environment, which actually places the regular everyday person who would want to be studying something of this nature to immerse themselves in it. In return, what we get is unnecessary traffic to and from these areas. And people even, we can look at this as being refined with AI to the extent of being able to do research on it as well. So it's quite immersive.
Now, one of the things you mentioned to me earlier was that there was a study using AI for a site in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe. And Göbekli Tepe has many figures that are representational animals that are depicted. And this was quite mysterious. Can you tell us a little bit more about the AI study?
Yeah, actually, it was surprising that it was able to decipher or decode, if you will, the animal symbolism involved at the site Göbekli Tepe. And that Göbekli Tepe's culture has got remarkable similarities to the Native American cultures here using animal symbolism.
Absolutely, I'd agree wholeheartedly. Now, what they found was at the Göbekli Tepe study was they began to look at the imagery, the animal imagery, and identify spatially where that animal imagery is situated geographically, and also looking for patterns and co-occurrences of those images. And the AI study came up, or at least concluded as a working hypothesis, that there are correlations between those particular images and certain star clusters, certain star patterns, certain star constellations that exist that have similar names as some of the animals that are represented on those columns. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And now we are able to start to actually apply digital 3D mapping on an AI level also on these sites to see other elements of these sites on account of the discovery with AI science and Göbekli Tepe, and actually start to apply different sciences. I happen to have a patent that I created in 1999 called "A Method and System for Estimating Earth Environmental Effects in Relation to Planetary Orbital Dynamics." This science is based on Albert Einstein and quantum mechanics. There's conjecture behind it, and as it's explained, it evolved to what's called a divisional patent that is considered a divisional patent. That's why they call it method and system. Now that science has evolved 25 years here later, with AI science, we can actually start to apply this these quantum mechanics behind the lines in trying to catalog and create prototypes for the scientific disciplines within the scope of our research.
Gotcha. Well, I think it's a good place to stop. Why don't we take a break? See you on the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is the 155th episode, if you can believe it, for your archaeology podcast. And we're blessed and honored to have Joseph Williams, who's the founder of the Seven Fires Corporation. And we're talking about archaeoastronomy. We're talking about understanding the indigenous, Native American, and worldwide theology, religious metaphor, that involves the study of the night sky and the day sky, for that matter, as well. Joseph, introduce the subject for us and give people maybe an understanding of why this is important.
Absolutely. Archaeoastronomy, I think, is for the most part a fairly new science that I believe that the general public is only becoming now aware of. And it happens to be that practically all, in my opinion, with thorough study, that these sites incorporate, a mapping of the sky, of the night sky, with the seasonal precessions and equinoctial points. And it's very interesting to try to understand a culture, you know, thousands of years evolved, of being able to record these things in these sites involving, a star systems, for example. The Sirius system, for example, is actually considered represented in the mortars that are in the bedrock at this particular site that we work with, named Village of the Sun, I think it is. And it's very interesting for someone like the general public to be able to witness and understand, have this understanding of these sites.
So when you think about the Native people, what we're thinking about is the indigenous people, the foragers, the hunter-gatherers, and they were very interested in following the seasons and the movements of the sun, and also, of course, the moon as well, and the movements of the celestial sphere, the stars. But I think one of the primary elements that many of these forager communities, complex foragers and simple foragers, were after was the winter solstice and the summer solstice, What that meant was, as we watch the sky, and this is something that people may not be aware of, the sun moves in the heavens in terms of where it arrives in the morning and where it drops off in the evening. And often it was the native habit to be able to synchronize the horizon and see where that sun would arise, often during the winter solstice sunrise, because that is the farthest it moves in one direction. Am I correct?
Yes, actually, yes. The equinox, and trying to understand where a count is actually based on, so that the Native American was able to use these counts, but they had an understanding of it in such a way that they based their daily activities on this count, because this is their understanding, and it's a very healthy understanding, in my opinion, to have such an understanding of the universe that surprises even the scientists today on how well they were able to understand the heavens, such as the star system Sirius, which is incorporated.
Yes, exactly. So if I'm going to give you some examples, there is a site in California in the far Southern Sierras that's known as the House of the Sun. It was given that name by the native people, the Tobalabo and the Kawayasu. And on that site, which is a very large split rock above a drainage, is a picture of the sun coming up over a mountain. It shows rays, and there it is. Well, my colleague, Dr. Robert Schiffman, one of the pioneers in archaeoastronomy, thought that particular image related to the winter solstice sunrise. And so as he went out to experience that on December 21st, when you stand in front of that image, you see the sun itself coming up over the highest mountaintop, that's Owens Peak, right there on the horizon. And it sits there for several seconds before it begins to move off to the north. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of these sites, they have a certain form about them that is very remarkable, in that their forms, the Native American culture was able to actually use as a gift from.
Right, it's sort of a hinge point that they can remark or connect that with their calendar, identifying exactly when that sun has moved as far afield as it can on its travels, right? And then what happens when you look at that? It looks like it's sitting there for several days, not moving. Now, that, of course, is just a function of sort of the horizon and the way we see things. It really is moving, but not very much. And even for the Hopi, they have sun watchers, and the sun watchers will coincide certain ceremonies relating to having to move the sun, pick up the sun, and have the sun begin to travel again, re-energize, and move in the heavens along its transport back towards the other way. And that fits also in their sacred narrative. Am I right, Joseph?
Yes, exactly. And it's really interesting to think that maybe it would be they were able to define that the wobble effect, if you will, which is a scientific fact, how that was actually understood in the sense that the markings that they had made weren't consistent for a particular period of time, 6 or 10 year intervals, that they noticed a difference in where these marks with the sun rising and the sun setting actually laid. So it's very remarkable.
So it's part of their cosmology, part of their direction of connecting with the natural environment, so exactly. That they know how the celestial, you know, elements interact with the world and how that's timed to the various periods of time when certain animals or plants might be available, might be timed with certain key harvests or certain hunts, and that would help with knowing seasonally where we are in the cycle. Does that make any sense, Doc?
That is completely correct. I mean, there isn't no words that could have explained that better. In animal symbolism, that is a true fact that we are learning now, in how animal symbolism was represented in such a way as to connect with the star systems and the heavens.
Now there is another site that both Joseph Williams and myself are aware of. And I had the honor of being part of a study, an extensive study of that site, to put it on the National Register within the National Mojave Preserve. And it's called Mary's Cave. And the reason I bring that up, it's one of the most extensively studied archaeoastronomical sites that exist in California. And there was an astronomer that actually studied that and published 2 books on it, each one taking him 5 years of study. But you've got a similar situation there, where if you're at the cave, in the cave, for the winter solstice sunrise, you will see where the sun rises on the horizon, coincident with a notch on the looking away towards the mountains. And that particular incident triggers the ceremonies and the coming of age rites and the associated elements that are part and parcel of that particular place. Now, partly the reason we sort of knew this or had any inkling of it was the entire ceiling of a rock shelter is covered with celestial symbols, stars and moons and brightly shining objects that appear to have trails and look like comets. I've never seen a site more supernaturally celestial as Mary's cave. So, Joseph?
Exactly. I'm needing to actually get to that site, do the recordings that we're looking to catalog. That's even on the base sites, because surprisingly, there's many of these sites like Mary's Cave on Air Force bases.
Yeah.
And China Lake is one, as Edwards Air Force Base is another. And being able to access these sites now with our instruments to be able to record and start to give the general public an educational path that they
can... a glimpse of what we can have. Let's close it there and we'll continue in the next segment. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we're in the third and final segment of your episode 155 of the Rock Art Podcast. We're here with Joseph Williams, founder of the Seven Fires Corporation. That's a Native American corporation that does outreach to protect and conserve heritage sites because of their important cultural values for Native Americans. Joseph, tell them a little more.
Thank you. I appreciate having this opportunity to be able to express not only my concerns, but my gratitude for, believe it or not, the evolution of AI science, being able to get us to the forefront of technology when it comes to archaeology, and being able to incorporate that science even to the extent of archaeoastronomy is really fascinating. I had a simple structure that I've designed a lot of the science that I base quantum mechanics due to a patent S6038512. And it's almost like I can make a song of it, but it's a method and system for estimating Earth environmental effects in relation to planetary orbital dynamics. And that's very complicated for something that could be put on paper in 1999. This was way before AI or even cell phones for the general public. Now it's an opportunity, I see, for this corporation, Seven Fires Corporation, to incorporate an intertribal management that we can run a corporate, a nonprofit, if you will, for being able to have a web interface for sevenfirescorp.org, I think, is that public education link that we can use to interface this technology to the general public involving archaeology as a whole and Native American culture.
Great.
To give this an outreach program, for example, the web, being able to bring this as science projects to high schools, having it part of the college curriculum, maybe even using college campuses for our lectures.
Who would you think might want to contact us regarding any of this? Would it be Native Americans? Would it be college teachers? Would it be
Absolutely.
Students? Yeah, anybody
Absolutely.
Like that. Okay.
We have a booth that we want to present to the local powwows here in Southern California. And
Great.
It's a very nice looking booth. In fact, we had it at the convention for the American Rock Art Research Association and that convention.
And it was well received, absolutely.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we want and need to incorporate an intertribal management and government of this corporation. And the only way we're going to get this is to be able to be completely transparent. And I think a 3D environment that we can introduce to the public, and we can have that transparency.
I agree. Absolutely. Now, one of the things we've done in my former association was to set up a display at the California Welcome Center in Ridgecrest. And what it was, a virtual reality display where people could put on the headsets and they could see when they would visit this Welcome Center, see more about visiting certain rock art or Native American heritage sites and physically go there, in the essence, electronically, digitally, because it would be available to be seen in such a three-dimensional way. And these headsets were such that if you move your head one way or the other, you could actually see different parts of the actual sites or the actual rock art displays themselves. So the resolution on these, the new digital headsets, the VRs, are so rather astounding. They're rather impressive, and they've moved out of the, you know, the comic book stage to something that is truly impressive and very realistic. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Most definitely, you know, being able to catalog our research and have the 3D environment that people can immerse themselves in, hopefully in the not far future, be able to have this available for people within their homes who may be disabled or something of that nature, that really take advantage of one of these 3D environments in their home. So
exactly.
We'll have to see how this technology goes, if we can reach those who are unable to...
disabled or seniors or those that, you know, are unable to actually personally visit the sites, but they can experience them through virtual reality. And I've seen that happen, and it's rather amazing. I have a friend who's certainly on in years. Her name is Eve Ewing, and she's been out to the Great Mural Rock Art in Baja California, in Mexico, for quite a number of times. And she got to see it using VR, and she was just blown away. She started lecturing with the headset on and saying, well, this is this and this is that. And people were rather impressed at the enthusiasm and engagement that this kind of technology elicits. And
exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly. One of our primary focuses was data security. And with the new security software out now, it gives us the security needed for our research and proprietary needs as well.
Got it. I think that's all for now. If you have a few words to sign off, Joseph?
Actually, I can only say thank you again for having me on. And it's an honor. It's an honor. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. See you all in the flip-flop, gang. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.